This is the Homebrew Game Club, a podcast about modern, brand new aftermarket video games for retro consoles. My name is Nick, also known as DVertov, and joining me today are my usual co-hosts, Bart and Connor, but we also have a special guest, Matt Hewson. Matt is the creator of Witch and Wiz, the homebrew puzzle game for the NES that we recently covered on this podcast. He's also been an early supporter of the Homebrew Game Club since the very beginning, so we thought it would be fun to have him on for one of our mini episodes as our first interview. So welcome, Matt Hewson.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I just want to be totally honest up front. This was actually a scheme to meet our quota of dropping your name on our podcast. So yeah. I think that we have actually mentioned you on almost every episode that we've done.
I love people talking about me. You know, this is a bit of a tangent right off the bat. Last night, I literally found a Reddit post about me, like someone taking a tweet I had made once and like a 400 page discussion thread.
Oh,
on it.
No.
Wow.
It was quite bizarre. Yeah. With a giant, and like, I guess the default picture is maybe my Twitter photo, like stretched up to 1080p. So it's just like a giant shot of my forehead.
Wow.
Yeah. Quite bizarre to find. Yeah.
Just a random tweet that you had, like, just like,
well, it was about like cloud gaming. So there's some like people who really care, like have strong opinions about that stuff. It wasn't like a bad thing. It wasn't like, get a load of this guy. It was just kind of a random thing that I came across. I was like, this is weird. this must be what it's like to be famous.
Yeah. You're a famous homebrewer now.
Yeah. So
this is what happens when you release NES homebrew. You get incredibly famous to like five people, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So do you guys just want to jump into the interview let's see, anybody have anything to talk about before we start?
Happy St. Patrick's Day early, you know, I just want to wish that to everybody. That's my vibe. I don't know. Like, no, I'm happy to jump.
I had a shamrock shake at McDonald's yesterday. If that
did,
there you go.
You know what?
That counts.
For living in North America, that's basically the most Irish thing.
Basically Irish now. Whiskey shirt. If that
there you go. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to say Connor Nash has the best St. Patrick's Day parties that I've ever been to as an American. It's normally just about getting shit-faced drunk.
Yeah, and I'm not having one this year. I have to. I will be like, I mea culpa, because we're traveling to Ireland in like a week and a half. Like, we've got like the 14-day countdown, and there's a whole bunch of stuff we have to do for it. But yes, I would normally be hosting people to have a full Irish breakfast and cooking for them.
Full Irish breakfast. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's amazing. It's like sausage. You got the gravy. You got the, what is it? Is it the blood pudding? Is that what they call it?
Blood pudding, yeah. Black and white pudding. You got beans.
Guinness.
Mushrooms, if you're into it. Yeah, Guinness,
yeah,
of course.
It is a great way to go into your midday with incredible heartburn.
Yeah.
And a nice little buzz.
So, you know, about 6 months ago, Connor and I both went to the Global Food Store and like racked up on Irish breakfast ingredients.
Oh my God.
And then, because I came back from Ireland and I was like, I got to have this full English Irish breakfast again. He's like, let's go to the store. I'll tell you everything to buy. And so we did. I brought it home. I cooked it all. I served it to my family. Nobody ate anything. They were like, beans for breakfast? What is this shit? I was like, ah. I went into my midday that day having I was so full. I was like, I'm going to let it go to waste, you know.
Of course.
I don't know if I can get my kids to eat blood pudding.
No. I just said black pudding. I didn't say blood.
That's it.
Would have puked.
It's a bit branding, you know.
Yeah. I recently found that that black pudding in the back of my freezer.
Oh, nice.
It was in the back of my fridge. It was in the bottom of my fridge in the out in the garage, and it was. I was like, okay, that's why this smells out here.
Yeah, it's not exactly the most aromatic.
No, but it was a delicious breakfast. At least I thought so. The rest of my family, not so much.
Yeah,
it's an acquired taste. What can I say? Yep. Like poutine, right? I mean, I've never had poutine as a full meal. Is that a thing you like, Matt? I don't know.
Yeah. I'm shaking my head because I'm like, it's not an acquired taste. It's instant love for everybody I've ever met.
Love.
Yeah, that's true. I've never met anybody who said they didn't like poutine.
I've had a taste of somebody's poutine. I never ordered. Maybe I have to just like commit
or order. Tasting people's poutine. Come on.
Yeah. You just like strangers? You just walk up to their table?
What is it like? What is it like a quarantine thing here? Come on. You take a bit of your, like, you're drinking, you're having some fun, you're taking some somebody's food. Yeah. You're just like, oh, that's tasty. No.
Okay. All right. So Matt Hewson, famous homebrewer. So what you've, let me see. I'm thinking, so you've made Witch and Wiz. Mm-hmm. This you've also did From Below for the NES.
Yeah.
You work on games professionally.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Have you made any other homebrew games that we don't know about?
No. From Below was the first homebrew game I ever made.
Okay.
And Witch and Wiz was the only other one I ever made.
Okay. How did you get interested in game development? I guess, what is your, like, what's your professional background?
Well, like, my professional background is I work, like, on modern AAA shooters. So pretty kind of standard stuff for the industry. But, like, in terms of what got me into game development, I'm probably similar, like, hearing you guys talk about your childhood's probably very similar. I was born in 82, so I spent most of my childhood in the basement playing NES and completely consumed with it as, like, a cultural cornerstone for at least where I lived. So it was a huge part of my childhood, and then continued, like, video and Super Nintendo and 64, all that. And then in the, like, late 90s, I started getting into or discovered emulation, NES emulation, and kind of reignited that interest in the NES. And I started collecting physical carts back then, when you could get games for like 10 for 50 cents at a garage sale kind of thing.
So, I missed that.
That's when I got into it too. Yep.
Yeah. It was a pretty good time to collect. Yeah. So it's always been kind of, I ran emulation sites, stuff like that.
Oh, really?
So I was kind of like in the NES scene for a while. And then eventually I went to school for game design and development and went through like the traditional game dev career path from there. But on the side, I would always do smaller projects, indie games, 2D stuff that was kind of approaching NES, and it would get closer and closer with each project. I'd try to get more and more accurate to maybe not NES specifically, but kind of 16-bit, 8-bit aesthetics, eventually kind of landing on Pico 8, which you guys talked about on the podcast a bit. And at that point, it was kind of like, well, maybe I can just take the plunge. I'm kind of here already, another step, and I'm actually making NES games, kind of a childhood dream. And so that's how I built From Below. And then from there, Witch and Wiz.
You've done modern game design. You've done NES game design. What elements of modern game design do you think are able to successfully translate to the NES?
Like, most parts of modern game design can transfer. I'm trying to think of what, like, there's aspects of the NES that are just like totally different than modern. Like, the one that comes to mind is subtitles or something like
okay.
that. Like, there's no cinematics or anything like that. So thoughts on how subtitles should work, and should they have backings, and should you be able to change the font size and stuff, like, none of that is obviously applicable. But generally, I kind of approached Witch and Wiz as if it was a modern game with really strong technical limitations. So I didn't really think of it. Well, that's not totally true. I kind of thought of it that as its like core foundation, but then, as I mentioned, like, the NES is a big part of my childhood, and that nostalgic factor is obviously a big motivator here. So there are things that I intentionally maybe make slightly antiquated or less modern. Like, I do the Nintendo seal of approval on the front cover,
right?
That kind of stuff, like things that like don't really have a real meaning, that's strictly there just for nostalgia. And even the box design as a whole is a bit of a nod to the Capcom boxes with the purple border and the
red. Right.
Not exactly, but trying to evoke a similar feel. So stuff like that. And obviously even just making a manual for a game like this is really not necessary, but
right.
So I guess that's a little bit outside the game itself. Within the game, yeah, I tried to think of it as a game that would feel at home, or that would be enjoyable for anybody, like a 6-year-old all the way up to a 60-year-old. I tried to think of it as that kind of game. So all the art is meant to be like, it's a game that takes place in dungeons. It's wizards and fantasy and all that, but I didn't want it to look like a Dungeons and Dragons game. I wanted it to look more like Candy Crush than Dungeons and Dragons. So things like that. Those aesthetic choices are somewhat modern, I think, compared to what you see at the time, which were like Fabio, like on the cover holding a sword. And that's what it would have been back then.
I got a question for you, and that's about the design. Like, how long did it take you to design the character models? Was that like your first iteration? You were just like, okay, that looks good. Or did you have, you know, 5 or 6 other ones that kind of maybe were working, but not really?
Yeah, it's a little drawn out. Like, technically, the original character is from the Pico 8 game back in 2017. So right now that's about 5 years ago. So that was designed by another artist. And then the Nest Dev competition version basically had the Pico 8 character converted to NES specs. And then the final version is a reskin of that character. And that probably took, I don't know, weeks, maybe days to weeks to kind of iterate. I have a pretty cool sheet of like all the iterations that we went through to kind of get there. But yeah, it was like days to like a week or two, not a ton of work. And then for the key art, like the cover and the manual and all that stuff, that I did with an artist named Corey. And I basically sent her a paint sketch that I did, actually 3D paint. It was the first time I ever used 3D paint because you can actually...
I love her stuff. It's very good.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, she's really, really talented. And so I just sent her kind of the framing of the shot that I wanted and a little, some like art from the game. And she kind of just knocked it out of the park on the first try. So that was
great.
That was nice. And same with the special edition art, which has the wizard as well as the villain in the game as like an ominous thing over top. So she kind of just, I would say there was probably four revisions, but they were like 90% there, then 92% there, and just
that's awesome.
Minor iterations.
Well, and you also worked with a hand-drawn games creator. I can't remember his name off the top of my head.
Yeah. Philip Summer.
Yes. For the limited run, just a really beautiful poster.
Yeah, that was really cool. That kind of just worked out serendipitously. I emailed him earlier in the year before he had launched his Kickstarter, because I just kind of liked his stuff and said, hey, are you interested in doing something? And he was like, I'm pretty busy. And I was like, yeah, I'm not done my game, so I don't know why I'm emailing you. And then we kind of just lost touch for a couple months. And then after his Kickstarter got shut down, I just messaged him and said, hey, I saw that happened. If you're looking for something to kind of, I don't know, fill the gap or keep you busy or whatever, love to work together. And he was like, yeah, I need something to do. And yeah, worked out perfect.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned the Nest Dev competition version. And I just want to note for our listeners who may have listened to the discussion podcast that Connor has, in fact, finally played the entire full version of the game. He correctly identified it in the folder.
I was finally able to see that, yes, the file that was called Witch and Wiz full game was actually...
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. After you posted that, I was like, okay, I got to go and put like demo in the name or something. And I went and it had demo in the name already.
Yeah,
what do you want? What do you want from me?
Can you put red letters? Maybe a big F? I don't know.
It must have been like I looked at the first four letters of just like wit to okay, that's it. It's that's the W-I-T.
Yeah, that was tough.
He moves fast. He's a very intense person, Connor.
Great at puzzles, terrible at identifying games. There you go. Yeah. So that's
you failed the first puzzle.
Yeah.
You mentioned modern game design, and one element of that that really stuck out to me was the accessibility options that you put into it. Because if I think about NES games, they were kind of, many of them were the opposite of accessible. You know, they were often very obscure, even like just figuring out the basic mechanics.
Yeah. It was inaccessible almost in a more fair way, though. Like they were just completely inaccessible to everybody. So it's
true.
Like,
well, right. Yeah.
Equal opportunity inaccessible.
And yet people still have such an affection for games that are that inaccessible. That's what's, I think, very hard to communicate to like younger people about why the console is so fun.
Yeah. And I believe there's like a big piece of that that's missing, which is, at least for me anyway, you didn't really play games in isolation as a kid. It was, you had Nintendo Power, you had friends at school talking about things. It was a long drawn out thing. You didn't beat Zelda in an evening. It was a year long thing. And people would tell you, oh, burn this bush. I went through and like, it was like a community event to kind of figure all this stuff out. So I feel like that part's missing. So I played through Dragon Warrior recently and I used the guide from, I think it was Nintendo Power, came with the guide and it was awesome. It was such an amazing experience that you don't get if you just put that game in because it's totally obtuse. It doesn't really, half the stuff in the game's wrong. It's just like telling you random stuff that's not true. So when you got the guide, it feels like somebody beside you helping you.
It's funny you mentioned that because I remember playing a lot of those games, not even alone. Like we would get together with my neighbors at any chance to play. Yeah. You know, half the my first playthrough of Legend of Zelda was with my neighbors. You know, we would just sit there and one of us would do level one and then, all right, let me try level two. I couldn't get the boomerang. All right, I'll go for the boomerang. You know, it was really cool.
Sleepovers, rent a game, play it like 24/7 for 3 days over a week. Well, yes. I guess you guys had video rental stores, but
Oh, yeah, right. I could just go to my basement. No. But, well, I was just thinking about Castlevania 2, you know, because everybody talks about Castlevania 2 and how poorly designed it is because it's so abstruse, I guess you'd say. It's just hard to understand what's going on. The clues don't make sense. But, I mean, I beat it. I was like 10.
Yeah.
It was pretty easy to find resources to help you. I mean, any mall had a bookstore, and the bookstore had hint books, so.
Mm-hmm. I'm playing through that one right now with my daughter.
I love that game.
It's pretty obtuse. Like that
it,
one is.
Okay, it is. Yes. But you know what? Then you get the flame whip. You get the flame whip and it's all worth it because that thing rocks.
Yeah. But I'm using a guide for that one. And that, like, I basically have my daughter on the side with me and she's telling me where to go. And yeah, it's actually really, really fun playing like that. And I'm enjoying it. I'm loving it. I hated it as a kid, but now I'm actually seeing, like, once you know how it's supposed to work, it's actually a really fun game. It's not bad at all. It's just, how would you ever know to go to this wall with the orb and duck and get sucked away by a tornado, which is in Dungeons and Doom Nights. I don't know if you saw that.
Oh, I think I saw a GIF of that.
So wait, to be clear, you're playing the game and your daughter is on the guide, like basically as a navigator?
Yeah, exactly.
That's an amazing way to play.
Yeah, it's really fun. And then I have a younger daughter who's just like drooling on the manual, but it feels like she's part of it.
Also contributing.
Yeah. Contributing in her own way. Yeah. It's really, I love it. That's why, Anguna, that's basically how we played that. And I just loved it. It was it really felt like I was playing Zelda as a kid again. And we kind of knew what to do, but we didn't know where to go. And we're helping each other out. They were spotting stuff on the map. Like, hey, this looks suspicious. It's on the map. It's a big square with only one entrance. Like, obviously there's something in there. Let's go investigate and we'll work our way over there. And along the way, we'll find stuff on our own. And yeah, it was really, really fun.
That's awesome.
Really, that felt like a cross between Zelda and Star Tropics to me. I loved that game.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
I love the way that you described that, because to your point about the Nintendo Power stuff and the way things were when the games first came out, each game was so dominant in that video game culture. It was like, if you said, like, I've got Castlevania 2 at home, like, everybody you spoke to who was interested in video games at all knew that that was it. Like, oh my gosh, he's got Castlevania 2. I gotta just, like, I gotta see what this is about. And now, you know, I mean, just a bunch of reasons why, but like, if you say, oh, I've got Forbidden West, you know, Horizon Zero Dawn, Forbidden West, it's like, that's awesome, but it is a bit more of a solo experience. Like, that is something that you're doing more alone yourself. And I just, when you said Candy Crush, I mean, that definitely sticks out to me, because Witch and Wiz is just a really easy to pick up game, and it is more easy to access without having to know all of the culture around it and figure things out, and the visual language is very clear, etc. So, like, I appreciate that you've made Witch and Wiz in a way that doesn't require that level of community involvement in order to make it enjoyable, but I totally empathize with what you're saying. Like, by having a community around a game, it does make the whole experience more communal and more enjoyable in a certain way.
Thank you. Yeah, I think my next game is going to be completely based on that concept of, like, how do you take that concept of, like, a Nintendo Power sitting beside you and a map, and making that integral to the actual experience, a required part of it. And yeah, I haven't quite figured it out yet, but I think that'll be a key component to it.
To your point, I mean, I think part of that is, I mean, not to kind of, like, elevate ourselves, but, like, being in a media, or, like, you know, whatever you call it, like, landscape and the zeitgeist of people talking about it, and for it to be something that, you know, people are, like, discussing and interested in. And I'll tell you right now, we're going to hype the fuck out of that game. Like, that's the way it's going to go.
Yeah.
I'm going to phone it in then. I don't even
Yeah.
But like, just that, like, that whole idea of, like, it's going to be bigger than the game itself, right? It's going to be like, because I'd seen on the Discord you were talking about, like, doing a kind of a magazine type thing. So, like, I'm guessing that's what's part of the gears turning in your head. So, I mean, since there's not really an electronics boutique or a GameStop that this is going to be physically located in.
Walden Books.
Yeah.
You know, there's something else there in a media space, which I imagine podcasts may fill, or something else around forums or discords that kind of provides some of that community too. And I don't know if you've thought about that, or, you know, given some thought as to how that might influence your development of whatever you're working on.
Yeah, it's a little different than what, like what you're saying sounds cool, but I think it's going to be different than what you're expecting. It's not like exactly having a map or having a Nintendo Power. It's kind of, how do you take that feeling and put it in the game? And yeah, I don't know. I don't want to say too much, not because I'm like into keeping secrets. I just literally haven't figured it out yet. Right. And I don't want to say something and be like, actually, you know, it's something totally different.
Are you working on something else right now?
I'm working on a port of From Below to the Game Boy, but that was supposed to be just a quick little project, but I added multiplayer to it. I don't know what I was thinking. It's like a nightmare to that link cable thing is just, yeah, it's like 95% working. And then just once in a while, I'll hit a rare edge case bug. It's happening enough that I feel like people will see it. If it was really, really rare, and it was like maybe once in a while, someone's multiplayer game will be ruined, say 1 in 1,000, fine. But if it's like 1 in a play session, that's a bit too much for me. So I'm trying to like come up with something to get around it. But yeah, it's very challenging for my skill set. And I'm working in an engine on top of kind of the lower level stuff. So I can't see exactly what's happening under the hood. So things just kind of misbehave, and I'm kind of guessing what caused that and trying to reverse engineer in my head what would have happened to cause that, knowing what I know about the engine. So, and then just trying things to see if it works. So it's been really slow going, but I have an idea of how to fix the last few bugs. So tonight I'll probably try those.
You mentioned like 1 out of every like 1,000 games. What's your approach to beta testing? Because, of course, as I mentioned, I was a beta tester, very late stage on Witch and Wiz.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
How do you go about, especially for homebrew games, which it seems like it has such an inherently limited audience, how do you go about beta testing something like that? Yeah, how do you recruit beta testers, and, you know, what's your process for evaluating?
So, like, traditionally, I've heard really, like, horror stories of people, horror stories, that's a little bit strong, but people get like maybe 10 people volunteering to beta test, and then 2 of them actually play the game, like from listening to some Blue Line podcast and stuff. I've heard kind of stories like that. So that kind of had me worried, but it turned out to be the opposite of that. I had more people than I could kind of handle. Yeah, humble brag. Sorry, I didn't mean that to sound boastful. I was just saying it was a really good experience.
How do you think that happened? Like, how did you get so many people?
Yeah, so I think it's similar to how I approach also selling the games. Is a big believer that you're basically selling the game for the months and years before you actually release it. So you're building hype, getting a community involved, so that when the game's actually released, you've already sold it. They just have to kind of click the button to follow through. They've been sold on it for months. That sounds kind of like conniving and gross, but
no, honestly, I'm going to be honest. I think there's a whole episode there just around other people who are like homebrew developers looking to know how they should approach their game development. Because I think there is, especially amongst a hobbyist crowd, I think there is a very much like, if I build it, they will come kind of approach to this. And I totally see that that's not the right approach. Like,
yeah,
even from my limited exposure to the homebrew community, it's about making those connections, about getting people interested and aware of what you're working on before it's released to get that, you know, level of interest.
Yeah. And I think even more, like you touched on it, even more so with homebrew, because my feeling is most of these games, if they were just retro looking games on Steam, they would be pretty forgettable. They're not like the best games in the world. What makes them interesting is the story behind them,
right?
Overcoming these technical hurdles, that nostalgia, the fact that I can put it in my NES. But so I think you really need to kind of sell that story as part of it, or else it's just another game. It's not going to resonate in the same way.
Yeah, I'm glad you talked about that, because I do think that there are a lot of people, especially in homebrew, where, you know, it's different if you're coming at it from, if you've worked in media or entertainment, you know, if you've worked in video games professionally or something, you may know how important hype is. Whereas with homebrew, you've got people who maybe their day job is like an electrician or, you know, an insurance salesman or something, and this is just something they do on the side, and it's totally new to them.
It's really easy to feel like you're spamming or over communicating, spoiling the game, but this stuff just flies by a mile a minute. And right. I constantly get people saying, oh, I didn't know you were working on this. I'm like, I've been talking about it for a year on here. I post like every other day and people are still finding out about it for the first time every day. So it tells me that, okay, I need to keep posting. And I'm sure it gets annoying for like the people who are here kind of every day. And they're like, yeah, we get it. You're making a Tetris game for Game Boy. Get over it. But I'm kind of like, well, I gotta do it. I gotta annoy you a little bit to kind of make sure that people who aren't, because that's a big thing with marketing, is you want to make sure that everybody who would buy your game knows about it. That's the big thing. It's not necessarily convincing people that it's a good game. It's that people who would buy your game day one just don't even know it exists. So that's kind of how I approach things. So anyway, getting back to your question, I don't know if I actually answered it about the beta.
Oh, right.
Similar thing. I think I had kind of built up a bit of a community beforehand, so that when I made the call for beta testers, there was a lot of people who were already like, yeah, I'm ready to play this game. Let's go. So I had, really good turnout. And then I had, that's from below. And then when Witch and Wiz came, very similar thing. And on top of that, I was able to message all the people who were on the From Below beta. And the way I did it was I went through the Discord for the From Below beta, and everybody who contributed in that, that had signed up for the Witch and Wiz beta, I gave them priority access. Cause I was like, okay, these guys have delivered before.
Okay. Right. Sure.
They're ready to go. So I just let all those people in right away. And then the way I approach it is that every time I release a new version, I roll in a few more people to get some fresh eyes on it so that people are seeing it for the first time, as well as people have seen the issues, up to that point. And then, I just kind of try to stay engaged, make sure I'm answering everybody's questions. Yeah, I don't know. That's about it.
Yeah. Well, I loved beta testing your game. I felt bad because as soon as you made me a beta tester, like that day, I became a den leader for a Cub Scout pack. Yeah, it was like, that was a nightmare.
No, you did great. You were one of the guys who provided video, right, of playing?
I did, it. Yeah. Every minute I played the game, I had video of it. So.
Yeah, so that was super useful, especially... Was that the final version or the Nest Dev one?
That was the final. That was the final. That was the last beta before the release.
Okay. Because early on in the Nest Dev one, it was still important for the final one, but for the Nest Dev one, I was really off on my understanding of what's difficult and what's easy, and having those timings of people like, hey, this level took me 30 minutes. And I was like, oh, I thought that was the easy level, stuff like that. Or I thought this was really hard and people are beating it in 5 seconds, and you realize, oh, I was so zeroed in on this one solution, I didn't realize there was, like, you could just walk across the stage and finish it in 5 seconds.
Well, I'm glad that you said that, because that's going to segue into my next question. When I play a puzzle game, one of the things that always sticks out in my head, whether it's a classic puzzle game or a modern one or whatever, is how do you gauge the difficulty of a puzzle? That seems to me to be, would be the most difficult part, or one of the most difficult parts of making a game like this. So how do you go about designing a puzzle, and how do you figure out what is difficult and what isn't?
I'm not super scientific about it. Like in my head, I think of it as what makes a puzzle in this game difficult are the number of choices and the number of branching paths combined with the number of last moves that you can do. So on a lot of puzzles, you can see, okay, this enemy is the last one I have to kill, because once I drop down here, there's no way I can get out of there. So I can just put that one off the table. And then there's a few that are, I can kill this guy without altering the game board at all. So they're just freebies. So the more of those kind of things, the easier the puzzle is. And the more choices of, I could totally go left, or I could go right at the start. That's a huge branch right away. So that's kind of in my head how the complexity adds up to make a difficult puzzle. But I don't actually like do anything with that knowledge. I don't have a spreadsheet or anything like that where I figure things out. I just, I basically
you don't have a closed form mathematical equation.
I probably should. Like, I'm sure. I'm sure you could come up with something pretty good, but I don't really design like that. I'm a very like feel kind of guy. So the way I design them is, I start with a core concept to a puzzle. Like, say I want these blocks to feel like an elevator that you're kind of traveling down, say, just something simple like that. And I'll build that, and that'll usually be considered an easy puzzle. And then if I need a hard puzzle, I'll then just layer elements on it. And I'll say, well, how can I make this choice a dead end? So I'll say, like, if you kill this guy first, it means you're stuck. And if you kill this guy first, it means you can move on. And then I'll layer, kind of what I was saying a second ago, I'll layer those throughout the puzzle. And the deeper they are through the branches of choices, the more challenging it'll be. And I just layer stuff and keep layering and layering until I feel like it's really difficult. And then a lot of the time I would do exactly what I just said, where I'll do all this layering and it'll just, I'll realize at the end, like, oh my God, I just left open this beeline to the last, to the enemy. It's a joke. And I have to kind of go back and add complexity and
stick three blocks there quick.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I almost shipped with one or two that, yeah, were total blind spot puzzles where the solutions were dead simple and they were meant to be the last or second last puzzle in an area. So yeah, it's really good to have beta testers. They catch that stuff pretty easy because they're not thinking about this. Like, I have a solution in my head that I'm kind of working with.
As I was doing my beta test, I was, you know, I was recording video, as we said, and I know exactly how long it took me to finish the game. So it took me just under 4.5 hours. So yeah, one of my very mild criticisms of the game was that I felt it was a little short, which my podcast co-host did not. I think you guys probably thought it was just the right length, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Goldilocks,
right? Yeah. Just right was a real theme there. Yeah.
Yes. The Goldilocks, the meaty Goldilocks game. How do you determine when the game is long enough? Like, when did you just kind of say, like, this is it, this is good, I'm done?
I wasn't thinking too much about the overall length. Like, I thought about it, but I kind of just thought 100 levels is what most games do. So I kind of just started there.
Okay.
But I put a lot of thought into the length of each area to make sure that it was constantly feeling fresh, especially after watching the Nest Dev playthroughs. You can see, especially with streamers, hitting a point where, like, they're kind of getting bored.
Oh, okay.
And I think it's amplified in a stream because you're trying to entertain people, but you can kind of have that feeling that, oh, they're so close to the next area, but they're getting stuck and they want to put it down and walk away. So yeah, I thought a lot about basically how long is this mechanic fun? And I think you guys talked about it a bit in the Witch and Wiz episode, but leave people wanting more, never feeling like, oh, I'm kind of sick of this. I'd much rather have people say, I wish there was more. Let me buy the sequel.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah.
So how did you come up with all the different mechanics? Because you do introduce them. It feels like just at the right time. How did you go about, like, how did you just brainstorm, like, all the different little things that you could do in the game? Because it does always feel fresh.
I literally just, like, drew them on paper. I didn't have, like, a real source of inspiration, I don't think. I would look at, like, different games just to see if they would have ideas, but I can't remember any that I was able to steal. Like, I looked at Fire and Ice and Lolo and Load Runner, but they didn't have a lot of, like, those games are very one note through the whole thing. They're kind of what you guys were talking about, where it's like, let's examine every possible combination of mechanic you can do with, or puzzle you can do with this one mechanic. So yeah, I didn't pull a lot of inspiration from other games, even the obvious ones like VVV. Maybe I was thinking about that, but I don't know. I wasn't intentionally taking that. So it was just kind of obvious stuff to me. I would think, I don't know where the inspiration came from, but my process once I had an idea was I would draw it out on paper, the basic mechanic, try to design an easy, a medium, and a hard puzzle. And then it's actually quite challenging for me to design a hard puzzle. So if I can't design a hard puzzle with this new mechanic, I know I'm in trouble, because I know I'm going to be struggling even with a really solid mechanic. But if I have a mechanic where from day one, I can't even do one hard puzzle, like, there's just no way it's going to be tenable. And then I guess I scale that by the complexity of how hard it will be to implement. Like, I had one idea where there would be geysers.
Okay.
And they would kind of act as elevators, but you could put blocks, push blocks onto them, and that would raise the other geysers. So it'd be this whole kind of push pull. It would add verticality to the game, which is missing in some extent. So
okay,
that was cool, but I can't remember if I struggled to design hard puzzles. I probably did, because I did in almost everyone, but the technicality of it was also quite complex. The inverse of that I had was this idea of lava pouring down from, like, holes in the side of, in the back wall, so they would kind of pour out and it would spread over the floor pieces. So it would create these kind of vertical rivers, and you would have to block them or like create bridges to go under and stuff like that. But that one, yeah, I couldn't come up with any good puzzles for it. Huh. And it was quite complex to implement. So I was like, it's not worth it. There's stuff like gravity flipping was really easy. That's basically almost free in terms of complexity of implementation. Ironically, like I call them the labyrinth levels, the portals where you go from one side to the other, kind of an old school asteroids mechanic. That was actually one of the most complex.
Really? Huh.
Yeah, in like a kind of silly way, but because I designed the game for CRT.
Right.
So I needed to make sure everything was within the save frame. So usually you would just say, like, once you go past 0 into -1, the way the numbers work on the NES is that just automatically goes to the other side of the screen. Because -1 is equivalent to 255, which is the position on the right-hand side of the screen. So it kind of just naturally happens. That's why you get it in a lot of games. But I couldn't do that. I needed to say, actually, when you go past -16, I want you to go to 246 or so. I can't remember what the actual number was. So I had to like fudge all the numbers, and it was, yeah. And then from the roof, it was even more complex because I had to skip over the HUD and.
Right.
It was weirdly complex. And then he goes under the like little particle effect on the side of the screen rather than over top of it. And I have two copies of the player at that point so that you'll see them like both at the same time when the face enters the portal.
It sits
on the other side. So anyway, it's such a simple mechanic, but it started really simple. When I first did it, I just did the basic, and then someone was like, well, on a CRT, you're not going to be able to see it. And I was like, yeah, you're right. So I fixed it and turned into a bit of a nightmare.
Interesting. Well, those are my favorite levels. I really enjoyed those.
Yeah, I heard you say that. You know what's interesting? My favorite are the key levels. I feel like they're so clever, and everyone hates them.
I didn't hate them. There was just something about them that I think it was not being able to turn around. It was just,
I hated them. No, I'll just say I hated them.
Did you really?
No, there's nothing like super negative about it, but I do think it's really interesting because, first of all, this is a masterclass in just game design, the way you're describing this, the way you're talking about approaching all these mechanics. I just love way you're just very easily, you know, going between the worlds of technical constraints and artistic design. I love the way those two things are just like in the same room when you're talking about this. That's awesome. But I also...
Your design for the key sucked.
I get the impression that you spent a lot of time on the design for the key. I get the impression that you spent a lot of time thinking about those levels. Like, there's no level in the key, like, world, whatever you want to call it, that I think is lazy or straightforward. Like, every single one of those levels
they're well designed into. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was maybe one of those things where I've looked at the games for so long that the, like, micro change that adding the key to puzzles, like, to me, it's like, it's very, I don't want to say brilliant, but it's this like this twist. It's such a small change, but it completely changes how all the puzzles work. And I play with that by reintroducing a couple puzzles that were earlier in the game and adding the key just to show how this kind of dramatically changes things. Cause it adds that, yeah, the mechanic of needing to take something somewhere, which isn't anywhere else in the game, and the ability to pick stuff up, throw things. Right. I also like Mario Brothers too, so maybe that's why. But
that's it. That's why I don't like it. That's the whole reason.
Oh boy, you lost Connor.
Oh yeah, yeah. You hated it, eh? I don't understand that, but anyway.
I don't either. I don't either. Sometimes Connor has bad opinions. What can I say?
The key level, Mario 2, yeah. It's all coming together. But anyway, yeah. So I think as someone who played it since 2017, I guess, in a way, like, it was something new and fresh and felt very different from the other puzzles.
It definitely does.
Probably why it has friction with people. It's the most different in a way. It kind of forces you to play in a different way. And you can't turn around, which was intentional, but I get why, as you said in the podcast, like, it's obviously a game thing. Like, that person can turn around. My daughter, all the time when we're playing, she's like, why don't you add jump to the game? This would be so much easier. Like, what's the point?
It was like Lizard. Why doesn't he just have a gun?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I get the criticisms, but it's still my favorite.
Did you ever think about combining mechanics?
Yeah.
And like adding the flip with the key and stuff like that?
Yeah.
What was the reason you didn't?
So yeah, very intentional that they're not combined. I'm actually not very good at puzzle games. considering I make one, but I don't like in puzzle games, they get out of hand for me. It just reaches a point where it's so above my head. I can't mentally map how everything goes together. There's too many possibilities. So with this, I intentionally avoided that. I thought it would be more controversial that some, like, more people would want it to get crazy difficult, and they really like getting to the, and maybe they do, maybe they just don't play the game and they don't tell me anything. But that was an intentional thing to kind of make the difficulty have these ebbs and flows, that it always felt like you were kind of reaching a crest, dropping down, having some breathing time, and then slowly building up to another really peak. And my intention was that it would rise overall, that by the last sections, those would be the most difficult in the game, even though they have easy levels. The easy levels there would be harder than the easy levels earlier in the game. So that was very intentional, but I did originally plan to have hidden levels, which were going to be similar, you know, in Super Mario World, after you finish Star Road, you go to like Outrageous and Bodacious and all these like Tubular. They're like eight really, really difficult levels, the most difficult levels in the game.
I've never finished all eight of those levels. Those are
exactly really cool. Yeah. So my intention was to have something similar where, and actually it almost shipped in the game by accident, was on one of the gravity levels, you could leave the kind of confined area.
I remember that. Yeah, from the beta.
Someone found the bug. And then you were going to leave there and kind of go into I was going to have a little like glimmering portal off screen or off the player. And that would take you to this, and it would unlock these B-sides, essentially, that were going to be ultra difficult, combine everything, just go like no holds bar. They're not part of the core story, so I don't have to worry about difficulty or anything like that. But I just didn't have time to do it. That's all.
So you said what you meant was you are not good at playing puzzle games earlier.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you good at Tetris? Because that's one thing that when I was looking at From Below, because I believe, if I remember your Twitter feed, you actually consulted like really hardcore Tetris players.
Yeah.
When you designed that game to tweak it to their kind of modern standards.
Yeah, I had no idea the depths of Tetris when I started. Like, I would consider making it to level 10 like very good for me when I started, and only slightly better than that now, and I wasn't in like into the Tetris scene at all. It was really just a good first project when I started it.
That's interesting.
But yeah, I learned. Like, luckily those guys found the game because they told me all this stuff I had no idea about, that I wasn't even thinking, and stuff that I thought was I was doing well, they were like, this is so broken, you cannot ship this. So I'm very, very thankful to those guys. They saved me.
So the reception from the hardcore Tetris community has been pretty good for that game?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it's not like a runaway success or anything, but I don't hear anything negative. Everyone who plays it seems to really dig it. It's a weird mix or not a weird mix. It's a mix of modern and classic. So it's hard with a game like that because people play like professionally, they get really, really used to how it is, right? And even if maybe objectively I'm adding something better, the fact that it's different at all is kind of a deal breaker for a lot of people, which I even feel, even after playing From Below for so much, I can't play NES Tetris anymore because it's too sticky. It's too slow. Yeah. I mean, can't play. That's a little strong, but I notice it. Or I was playing Tetris Connected, the kind of VRE one by the Res guys. And it uses like the modern rotation system, which is like things rotate backwards from how they did in the NES days. And even that is enough to totally throw me off my game now. So I get where people come from there. But yeah, generally people who do kind of spend some time with it seem to really like it from that community.
So I talked about the portal levels being my favorite. And in fact, I was walking around all day today, the last several days actually, and I've had a tune like humming in my head, and I realized it was that level. It was the music on that level. That's one of the reasons why I love that level so much. I do love the soundtrack, and I love everything Twee does. Your homebrew, at least, is you don't have a lot of collaborators, I don't think, do you? It's just you, pretty much?
No, I have quite a few. Well, okay. Like all the art, I don't do any of the art.
Okay.
Or music. Or programming. No, I'm
kidding. Okay.
I'm joking. I program. programmed and designed.
Okay. Okay. Well, you know what? Just scratch that. Let's just scratch everything I just said there. So
as you're a far huge as collaborator.
The many collaborators that you work with, like, how do you go about like working with folks to kind of realize the vision that you have for the game? Kind of share that with people and get it on board to kind of sync up with yours?
I don't know. I don't have like a very thought out process. As I mentioned before, like I do work in modern professional game development and I am a lead there. So day to day, I do a lot of collaborating and kind of a big part of my job is, or as I see it, is giving people ownership over the features they're working on and feeling like they have direction, but also some skin in the game, and that when something looks awesome, they can take credit for it. And when it's not looking awesome, they also have to take ownership of that as well, but also not being lost at sea and just kind of coming up with random things until someone gives them a thumbs up. Probably that's the biggest thing, is I just kind of do it regularly. Finding people, I can't remember how I found, how do you say Tui? I call him Tui.
Tui? Yeah, Tui? I don't know.
Tui.
It's, yeah.
Do not take Nick as an authority on pronouncing. Because
I think it's French too. So
we should
be saying this with a French accent. Right?
Well, my Spanish teacher's daughter in high school, that was her name.
That was her name?
Yeah, and she pronounced it Tui as well. So.
Okay.
All right.
Tui or Tui?
Tui.
Tui. Okay. Yeah.
Since we were talking about him on the last episode, he actually changed his Twitter profile to his real name.
Ruined your whole commentary on it.
I know, right? All of my jokes are stale now. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Tweet.
I stopped the podcast right there. I was like, what is he talking about? Terrible. There's no bird in this profile.
Vincent
is his real name. Okay. I wasn't sure if that was public, so I didn't want to.
That's for Verge.
Well, let's get another edit then. There you go.
Yeah. And his home address is.
Yeah. All right. No, it's public. It's on his Twitter. I can say
it. Okay, cool. So Vincent, yeah, I think I met him on the NestDev forums. I probably just posted something like, hey, I'm looking for music, or he had posted something saying I'm looking for a game to work on, and I messaged him. And at the time, he wasn't so prolific and working on every single NES game that comes out these days. So it seemed like
a podcast about NES.
Oh, yeah, he did the podcast music too. So it seemed like a pretty good find, but I guess about 30 other people felt the same thing. So yeah, he did my music for From Below, as well as Witch and Wiz. And then the artists, I worked with a guy named Alp. He goes by Alp Daniel. He did most of the character work.
Okay.
And then another, I don't know why I'm saying people's names as if you're going to look this up, but Kenneth is the other guy. If you want to go search Kenneth. He did most of the backgrounds and enemies. He's actually like, he's a modern dev as well. I think he does like Roblox games.
Okay.
For like a professional studio. But he's super, I mean, they're both super, super talented. But he had never done NES stuff before. So it was a bit of a learning experience for him. Whereas he's been on the NestDev forums, I think, for years, posting lots of kind of random stuff that he's working on. And so I was super happy to get him. And then I worked with another guy named Haller Zoltan, who did the art for From Below, but he kind of dropped out of the project pretty early on. So there's a bit of his work in there. You see it in the forest levels, probably some other places that I'm forgetting. But oh, he probably did the original castle tile set.
Okay. Yeah, I had no idea you had this many collaborators. That just goes to show you the quality of the podcast that you're dealing with here.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Sorry about
no
that.
No stone left unturned.
We do minimal research.
Should have just checked the credits, but there's like 30 people in the credits. No, but yeah, so I work with, I'm like not talented at art at all. But the thing I love about the NES is that someone who's not talented at art can take something from somebody who is talented and actually make minor tweaks and kind of work with it. And it's something that's malleable to a non-artistic person. Whereas in modern dev, like I can't go grab like the Marcus Fenix model and like adjust his like eyebrows or something. I don't know what I would want to do, but it's just so out there. Like there's tools within tools within tools to kind of get through to there. Whereas here, yeah, I can open it up and paint and make edits if I want to. So I find that quite powerful and empowering.
Yeah, cool. So you did a physical cartridge of this game, mm-hmm. and you did it through Limited Run, which I was really impressed that you got a Limited Run release. That's super cool. How did you end up working with them? Did you reach out to them, or what? how did that go?
Yeah, I just emailed them. Like, yeah, sure.
Wow.
It was pretty straightforward. I actually get the impression they're like they would do a lot more if people asked.
They do seem to be wanting to break into more NES releases and retro game releases.
Like they're, I don't even think they played the game before they said yes, to be honest.
No kidding. That's wild.
I probably just sent them some GIFs and yeah, they seem pretty eager, like not desperate or anything. They were just like, oh yeah, sounds cool. We can do that. Huh. I think they just have a really good workflow set up where they've shipped some games, like they did Thomas's games, Jane Silent right. Bob and some other, the golf game, Golf, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, if I remember correctly, he was actually, he knew one of the creators or one of the founders of Limited Run. So they had a relationship going back a long time.
Yeah, but I think so. I think, okay, this is maybe airing dirty laundry. I don't know. But when I was first talking to Limited Run, I was a little nervous because I didn't know kind of what their background was, if they were going to screw me over. So I messaged Thomas and was like, hey, are these guys just scumbags? I didn't say that, but I was like, are these guys, like, was your experience good? All that. And he's like, Yeah, it was good. Also, like, I'm best friends with the founders. I was like, okay, cool. I'm glad I didn't, like, come on too strong there and just, like...
Glad you didn't come up with that scumbag comment. Yeah.
No, I didn't have anything negative happen. I was just like, I don't... It's basically, like, I was talking to kind of all the people you would expect, like Broke Studios, Soul Goose, 6502, trying to figure out what's the best fit. And so those guys are a bit of like all the homebrew community people are much more of a known quantity, right? I kind of know them right. from within and listening to podcasts for Soul Goose and stuff like that. So whereas Limited Run was like a bit like, well, this is a big outsider company, huge following. Like, am I getting into something?
Right.
I don't know. Are they just out to kind of exploit my game or something? I don't know. I didn't actually think that was going to happen, sure. But.
Well, these guys will tell you, I just love the gossip. I just love hearing gossip about stuff like this.
Well, it's kind of non-gossip.
That's it. I just like even the promise that you were about to reveal gossip just got me going there.
Yeah. I'm the same. I love the drama. All these people say like no drama on Twitter, all this stuff. I'm like, I'm subscribing. I want to find out what happens at the end.
Okay. Well, then I have to ask. I mean, it doesn't have to go in the podcast, but the...
What are your top 100 NES games of all time?
That's exactly what I was going to ask.
Well, I think I already kind of commented on that one in the Discord, but people just seem to go like off the chain on that one.
Did you hear our mini episode on it?
I did, yeah. I think just the thing that surprised me about the whole thing was how much assumed like vitriol like that this guy had. Like, he was just coming in to mess with people. Like, it just seemed like this assumption that I couldn't get where it was coming from at all.
I think for me, it was the fact that he came in and he kind of seemed to be like, guess what? The real guy's in town. I know how to run.
That's the thing. I don't get that. Like, I feel like he just said like, hey, this is what I do. And people are like, you're telling me what you do? You piece of shit. How dare you?
But to contrast with like your approach, which is effectively like, hey, you should put this label on your game if you want to be part of my club. Like, that's like much more appealing to those kinds of people, where it's much more like you elect to be ranked, because some people, I feel like they don't want to be ranked. They just don't want to be on the list for sure. at all. Well,
like, I mean, to me, it was like, I was listening to that episode the other day, and to me, it was just like, it was just a magazine article, basically. You know, the guy's like trying to make a magazine, and he's like, I don't know.
It was weird, too, how it kind of took off, too. Like, I'm sure there's a million of those lists out there, but for some reason, this one, I don't know. And it's not even from a game. Like, it'd be one thing if IGN... Like, I could see that. IGN ranks the top 10 homebrew games, and they put a Dreamcast game in the top 10. Like, people would be like, what are you doing? This is horrible. You're supposed to be professionals. But just some random top 10 list or top 100 list. I don't know. But as you said, like, Connor, I was there for the drama. I was happy to see it explode. Like, I enjoy it. As long as nobody's getting, like, seriously hurt.
I'm sipping my drink on the side. I'm like, this is juicy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love internet drama, especially when I'm not in it. I'm just observing from the outside. So yeah, Limited Run, limited physical release. Is there going to be another physical release at some point in the future?
Yeah, so the way it works is for 1 year after it gets released, they have like an exclusivity clause, so I can't release another game. So it sounds like likely it's going to come out in the fall of 2022.
Okay.
So probably the earliest I could do it again is fall 2023. So I'm not sure. I don't have plans at this point, but yeah, I don't know. It will be a while either way.
I know that they do digital publishing as well. Are there any plans to release the game on different platforms?
Yeah, I'm looking at some stuff. I got some stuff in the works.
Interesting. Okay.
Not necessarily with them, just
in the works. Okay. All right. So you talked about From Below on Game Boy Color. Are you working on anything else that you're willing to talk about? Or I guess you got a magazine thing going.
Oh, yeah. I'm working on a little magazine. I feel like that's maybe like a little, I don't want to say overhyped because I don't think there's any hype, but I think maybe I'm overselling it. It's really like my goal was to kind of collect. I see a lot of stuff kind of fly by on Twitter and Discord and stuff like that. And my goal was just to collect some of the cool stuff that I see and make like a little newsletter kind of thing. Like, here's 10 games that look pretty cool. But then I kind of started editing and like adding more and more and talking to people to get like exclusive content and stuff like that. And now I'm maybe, I won't say the other thing I'm working on, but there might be something more that's pretty cool in it. It's still pretty early, but yeah, it's kind of ballooned way beyond what I intended. I wanted it to be like a weekend project and it's turned into kind of a multi-week project. But anyway, yeah. So it's basically a digital magazine with, animated GIFs. I don't know, it sounds so basic, but I read the, you guys read Cool Shit Magazine. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I've got a couple issues of that.
Okay. So like, I really like that, but I find that I'm really interested in probably half the content that's in there. Cause it just goes so wide. It's like wrestling, G.I. Joe,
right.
Homebrew. So what I really want is kind of a distilled version of that, of just the stuff I'm interested in and less like opinion pieces. I don't want to do any. I used to, like I mentioned at the start, I used to run emulation sites and Nintendo fan sites and stuff. And like reading the stuff I wrote is just so cringy. I can't do it again. So yeah, I'll leave all the opinion pieces out and it'll just be kind of, here's like I'm writing up the Night of the Living Dead game right now. It's being done by this guy. Here's a bunch of screenshots and it'll be on Kickstarter on this date. It'll be almost like a catalog. I don't know. I was going to say, you guys skateboard at all when you were kids?
I did.
No, yeah. Not really.
Do you remember those like catalogs they used to send out, like California
skateboards? Oh, I did get those. Yeah.
With the, and you just go through and it'd just be like decks and decks and decks. Anyway, that's a weird analogy to make. There's probably something much more relevant. But yeah, just each page will have a game. And you'd be like, oh, that's cool. I want to look up more on that game. I'm trying to avoid putting anything too like obvious. I think it's pointless to just kind of duplicate what people have said a million times online already. So I'm trying to find stuff that's either lesser known or hasn't been announced yet, but really just what's of interest to me. So it's 99% NES stuff, a little bit of Game Boy. I would love to get some Genesis and Super Nintendo stuff in there, but I cannot find it for the life of me. Like I'm literally hunting for just like something, anything I can put in here. And there's just very, very little.
Yeah.
That isn't big. I feel like Genesis, there's a few games, but they're just like on Kickstarter already, or they're like big names like Watermelon or something. Like, so like, I don't really want to put that in there because everyone will just be like, I can look at that online. Why are you showing me this? I'd like to find something lesser known, but still interesting. But
I can say that's definitely a problem that we're having with this podcast because I want to find new platforms and branch out a little bit, but I don't even know where to go. You know, so on that kind of riding on that, would you ever consider developing for a different console other than the NES and the Game Boy?
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely.
I mean, I would consider it and then I'd say no, the NES. No.
Right.
I would say the NES is like that's the dream console for me. That's the nostalgic one. That's what I grew up on.
Would you say it's your Goldilocks console?
It's my Goldilocks. Yeah, I got it after my Atari. For my Super Nintendo, and it was just right. It was the one I have the most memories of. It's the most formative for me. Like, that's the one I have the memories of going to the video store, playing Super Mario Brothers 2 for the first time, the perfection exposed to me. And like renting a console before we owned one, all that stuff, playing we would rent Contra every, we'd rent an NES and Contra every single time for like, in my head, it was years we would be doing this.
Sure.
Like, why didn't I want to play any other games? And I couldn't beat Contra either. So, but anyway, that's the one I have all the memories for. So that's the one I really personally love. And then the Game Boy, I had a Game Boy as well, but it was never like in the same league to me. I never thought it was good. Even as a kid, it was annoying. I was before kind of the Pokemon era, so I kind of missed that boat. So anyway, long way of saying, yeah, I'm into it. I just bought my first Genesis, actually, sitting up there.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of exploring that. I'm interested in doing some stuff there. I find Game Boy development really interesting. There's a lot of kind of oddities to it, peripherals. I'm doing like Super Game Boy stuff, link cable. Yeah, there's just a lot of cool stuff to explore there. Whereas the NES is a bit more like there's mappers and stuff like that, but it feels different. It's more contained. Whereas Game Boy, there's all these things come external factors that I don't feel on the Game Boy. Super Nintendo and Genesis, like I'm interested in it, but I feel like they're too close to modern games and they maybe.
Right.
They also look so close that I think it's almost an uncanny valley thing where the parts where they can't quite match modern, it will stand out more. I'll be like, well, like, is this a modern game or is it an old game? And why is it not quite there? Whereas NES, it's obviously not. It's obviously going for a distinct retro look, even if you don't know it's an NES game.
Yeah. So.
But I don't know. That one really stopped me, but it's less interesting. It's more complex too. Like the stuff I was talking about earlier, where I can open all the Witch and Wiz pixel art and I can edit it and do it like somewhat competently. I don't think I would feel like that with Super Nintendo. That's getting into like shading and some more late sources. I don't know. What do artists do? That stuff. I wouldn't know what to do. It's a little more overwhelming. Same with the music and everything. It's more complicated.
So what are some of your favorite homebrew games besides your own? And is there anybody else that you want to maybe collaborate with? Any other developers on the scene?
I made a top 5 list, actually.
Okay. Wait, didn't you make a top 5 and like 2 of them are your games?
Yeah.
What's wrong with that?
Okay. That's my right. let me look. Anguna is one of my favorites. I mentioned it earlier. Yeah, already kind of talked about why it's one of my favorites. Just the experience of it was very nostalgic for me. Nebs and Debs. Probably one of my early favorites for homebrew, one of the first games I played, and I actually really, really love challenging platformer games. That's kind of what I want to.
Okay, how far have you gotten into that game? Because I find it just really hard.
I finished the first quest.
Okay, wow.
There's a second quest where you don't get continue, or you get like 3 lives for the whole thing.
Okay,
and then my NES froze due to a bug, I believe, at Nebs and Debs, not my NES, because I left it on for like a week straight. Because it has no save, so I'm
right.
I just left it on, and then I came back one day, and it was just It was doing something weird. Yeah, it wasn't frozen. It was just like run. I couldn't like scroll anymore or something like that. Anyway, so I haven't finished the second quest, but yeah, I love it. I think it's super challenging, but there's a lot of nuance to it. It's not. Yeah, there's some details to the way the game mechanics work that weren't immediately obvious to me that I found it really frustrating at first. But once I kind of got those subtleties, this is basically a way of me saying, get good.
Ah, ouch. All right.
But yeah, I love that game. I love the art style. I love the gameplay. I love the manual. I love the box art. I love everything about it. Nescape. It's one of my favorites as well.
Oh, that good. Was, maybe you can give me some hints.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Did you guys finish it?
No, we're going to do our live stream next Saturday. This interview is probably going to post after we do the live stream. But yeah, okay. As we're recording, it's
so you didn't finish it on the live stream.
No, I only played like 5 minutes into it. The live stream was mostly us trying to set up the live stream recording.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. So I thought I had missed the live stream, so I didn't.
No. Guys
dicking around.
Yeah, you missed us dicking around for 55 minutes and 5 minutes of us solving puzzles.
Yeah, he figured out. We dicked around for 50 minutes, and then Nick figured out like 6 puzzles in like a minute and a half.
Okay.
It was really weird. He was this, and now this. All right, we better stop.
Well, and I've started that game like 10 times, and I never get anywhere with it. So that was extremely bizarre that happened. But yeah,
I really liked that one. I'm not really a point-and-click guy at all, actually, but that one has a bit of sentimental value for me because it was I think the second homebrew I picked up, Micromages being the first. And it was also how I discovered the NES Assembly Line podcast and how I kind of got into this idea that, oh, maybe I can actually make NES games, especially listening to actually both Kevin and Bo. I think both of them had no real technical background or very limited.
Right.
And hearing how they kind of just muscled through it and were able to actually make games. I was like, well, I know how to make games. I think I could, like, this is probably something I can do. It always seemed very black box. Like, how does it, like, black magic, I guess is the word I'm looking for. That it's these hacker wizards, like in dark rooms with hoodies and green lighting, but it's not at all now. Like, that's my biggest surprise out of getting into homebrew is how doable it is. For the way I work, I don't think people who make modern like 2D games would have any trouble making an NES game now.
Huh.
You can almost work as if you're in Game Maker or something like that.
I love how many people that Assembly Line has brought into homebrew development.
Yeah.
It seems like it's been so influential. And I can say, like, I wouldn't be doing this podcast if it wasn't for Assembly Line.
I know.
It's like, you know, I can make a podcast about these. So it inspired me in that way. But
I listened to pretty much every episode probably 2 or 3 times.
Oh, wow.
Me too.
Yeah, because it's really fun. Because when I first listened to it, I started on, I think, the Netscape episode because I just backed it on Kickstarter, heard all this stuff. And I was like, this is amazing. I'm super into NES. As I mentioned, I've been kind of into this my whole life, but homebrew to me was like, oh, we can get something on screen, or like we hacked the NES to display a sprite. That's how I, or play tic-tac-toe or something like that. That's how I remembered it. Or at the most, like Hong Kong, like pirated bootlegs and stuff like that. So being exposed to this world was so weird. It was like this thing I love and such a huge part of my life. And it's just been waiting there this whole time. And I had no idea. So listening to that the first time, then going back and listening to all the episodes, it was very like wash over me kind of feeling. I didn't really know what they were talking about. They were mentioning these games I never heard of before. They described them, but it's obviously hard to really get a sense of it. So then I'd go back the second time, like a year or two later, and now I've played a lot of the games and I can kind of understand what they're talking about. They're interviewing the people. Yeah, it was such a great podcast. The best NES homebrew podcast. No, I'm just joking. That's supposed to be a dig.
Well, we're actually a general homebrew podcast, Matt. Oh,
yeah, that's right. We're not an NES homebrew podcast. Yeah, we're just a homebrew podcast. Right, yeah. So, yeah, I'll allow that comment to stay in the final cut. Sure. Yeah. So, no, you know, my thing, I do wish they publish more often. I know, like, Bo is, like, really busy, but it has been...
Yeah, just had a kid.
I think in April, it's been, like, a year since they published a podcast. Yeah. But, yeah, if they recorded more often, I probably would not be sitting here right now. Mm. Because I love to listen to them talk, because I do a lot of driving for work, and I did it too. I mean, I've listened to every episode of that podcast 3 times, like not without exaggeration.
Yeah, and it's very timeless, right? Like modern podcasts, it's kind of, you, like, it doesn't matter when you listen to the Quest Forge episode, because like Quest Forge came out 10 years ago or whatever. It doesn't, if it's 15 years ago now, who cares?
Right.
Although the news is a little dated. It was really weird. I think I sent in a question. Sorry, I'm like really going tangent here, but
no, it's fine.
The hardest part for me was understanding what Nintendo Age was and what what happened.
Oh, that's I actually sent in a question.
Yeah, I was like, what? Can you guys explain what is going on and like, and the way they talked about NES Dev and Nintendo Age and Video Game Sage, and I was so lost about what happened there.
Cotter and Bart have no idea what I'm talking about. Yeah,
It's funny, but I mean, because you mentioned it twice already, so I'm going to ask the question. What emulation site were you involved in? Like, I remember going on sites like, for example, plasticman.org and stuff like that. Okay. Would that have been in your kind of like wheelhouse?
I was a NARC site. I just logged people's IP and sent them to the FBI.
Ooh.
No.
Oh, nice.
No, you probably never would have heard it. My original site was called Emunation.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it was like emulation, but a nation. It was pretty clever, I thought.
Yeah.
Wordplay.
My friends and I, there's a guy I know who's from Ireland. He's actually living in Vancouver right now, and he got me into emulation around about
the time
when that was all a big thing. And those are names. Like, you know what Plastic Man was, right? That was a really big source for rhymes.
No, I never heard of that one, actually.
No, really? Okay. Well, like, yeah. But that's like, I feel like there's a click, right? There was a thing around that where people got interested and you were there in a different context and there was really interesting stuff and people discovered, wow, I can play these games again on my computer and I can emulate them. And that was like a really empowering thing. And there was a huge community that built up around that. And I was kind of there. My friend was more in there at that time, like posting on forums, things like that. And I hear all of the stuff you're talking about. And to Nick's point, I haven't a fucking clue what you're talking about. But the way you're talking about it is very evocative of those times, right? It's very evocative of like, there's a thing. It's going on. It's happening. People are excited. People are talking. Mm-hmm. People are making things.
Yeah.
And it's just infectious. It's just like, I don't need to care what the specifics are. I just know something interesting is going on.
Yeah, I was much more into, like, I wasn't really into the hardcore, like, emulation sites with just every ROM on it. Mine was more NES lifestyle website. No, something like that, where I tried to do more game coverage and more commentary and opinion pieces, and the ROMs were, like, a part of that. So, like, I was kind of, you know, NES World.
Okay.
NESworld.com. They're kind of like, or TSR's NES Archive. Mm-hmm. Those were more my inspirations, where they were about kind of discovering the unknown. Like, hey, here's like Little Samson. I still remember when Little Samson wasn't like a known thing. And suddenly everyone's like, oh, wow, my God, there's an amazing platformer that no one's played. And it costs $50. I'm never going to pay that.
$50. Now it can be yours for only like, I think, 3,000.
Yeah, it kills me. There's so many games, well, not so many, that in particular, I can distinctly remember, yeah, seeing it for $100 and thinking, yeah, this is ridiculous. Totally. NES games are getting out of control. That was like complete $100. I'm not going to pay more than it cost when it came out. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's funny because I listen to like old like podcasts from video game collectors that are like, you know, and the podcast episode will be like from 5 or 6 years ago, and they'll be like, oh my God, the price of these games is so crazy. And it'll be stuff like that.
Yeah.
Crazy. All right. We're kind of at the end of our list. Connor and Bart, do you guys have any other questions that I didn't put on here? That
just talking about the nerdiness of it, I guess this, like, I want to ask like a technical geeky question around like, you obviously coded this game, Witchin' Wiz, in C, and like, there's mm-hmm. some assembly language there. And you mentioned earlier how like you don't think that's really an obstacle to people. And so I do some coding stuff in like Python, SQL for my day job. And I have to say assembly language looks pretty intimidating to me.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything else you want to add to that about just like, yeah, you can get it. It's fine. It's cool. Like, just go for it.
Yeah, it's fine. It's cool. Just go for it.
Awesome. Cool. Let's answer my question. Cool. Move on.
No, I'll say, not to like self-promote, but if you go to matthewson.com, I wrote a blog post on how to like get into NES development.
Right.
And it's kind of focused on like what your background is. And it's almost like a choose your own adventure, but basically like, where are you now? So someone like you has done coding, what would I recommend you start with and what's the mm-hmm. next step? So I would say like, if you can make a game in Pico 8,
right,
you can definitely make a game on the NES. Is a little bit more complex.
Yeah, that might like follow on just because you mentioned Pico 8 is like, do you write any of your games in Lua and then compile that down to C? Or is that just like, you just go straight C?
No, C is basically Lua. Like they're comparable for sure. Lua's got, well, I don't know. They're slightly different. It has objects
and stuff, but yeah, it's like.
Yeah, which C doesn't have. Yeah, it's, I guess it has tables in Lua. You can treat as objects. Sorry.
There you go.
Anyway, I don't know what I'm talking about anyway. I don't know. I'm correcting people. I don't know shit about Lua. But anyway, my point is, yeah, I would like for someone like yourself, I would say if you haven't before, get Pico 8, try to make a game in there, even Pong or something, because that's 99% of it. If you can get something on the screen, handle user input, because that's something I think is intimidating from people who maybe come from web or back-end engineering, they may not like the idea of a game loop is somewhat foreign, where you're just like updating every frame and things happen over time rather than just process all the data and output the results. Like maybe you think about things asynchronously or running in threads or something like that, but you're maybe not thinking of like moving in time steps across the screen, stuff like that. But anyway, If you make a game in Pico 8 or similar, I just mentioned Pico 8 because it's kind of, it's got everything you need in one package. It's like 10 bucks. There's a huge community. So if you can make something in there, the jump to NES is really just about learning what are the hardware limitations, what are the different tools to use. But the kind of 99% of the coding is the same. It's very, awesome. Very simple.
Thank you.
Assuming you go with C. But people who know assembly, like, say that C is more complicated, which I get what they're saying. Because assembly, there's like 6502, there's what, like 56 instructions or something like that. Which, again, I don't know what I'm talking about. So take that with a grain of salt. But it's very small, right? You can.
Yeah, there's hidden instructions and whatever. But yeah.
I think the hard part is figuring out, well, how do I turn those small number of things into something much more complex, which is what I struggle with.
That's the part that I struggle with too. So that's very gratifying to hear you struggle with it. Thank you, man.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. I only touch assembly when I have to. And even then I'm not, like, I've written a few functions. I don't even know what they're called.
Subroutines.
But very, very little. Mostly I'm just in there trying to figure out, like, what went wrong, because I'm using somebody else's code for the assembly side of things, and how do I tweak it? Like when I did the versus the Nintendo versus arcade port, I did a port of From Below. And so in there I had to kind of do palette swapping and stuff like that. But anyway, so it was just like kind of going in, spending days just figuring out how it works so that I can change one line of code kind of thing. So that's how I work. But I feel like the speed of working in C is just amazing. The speed of iteration, not the performance.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a very comprehensive technical answer in a very short period of time. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
So what you're saying is you don't make games by just typing it into the Game Genie. And like, that's so far out of my wheelhouse. That's what I was picturing creating games, just typing in codes into the Game Genie. Just like,
I thought everybody makes games in Microsoft Paint. I don't understand anything that you guys are saying. Yeah,
it's funny though, because you mentioned that I watch, there's some YouTubes, YouTube people who do like analysis, like Retro Game Mechanics Explained. I don't know if you've seen that, but they'll like break down how licensed error games work and put up Game Genie codes to like manipulate things. And I find that stuff extremely complicated, way more complicated than building a game from scratch. Same thing with hacks. I look at some of the hacks. There's these kind of total conversion hacks that to me is light years ahead of anything I'm doing. So yeah, that's the stuff I find most complex, is being able to jump into somebody else's assembly code, disassembling it, figuring out how it works, and then actually changing it and working within their boundaries. Cause there's all sorts of like limitations people put on themselves when they formulate these games and finalize how the memory is going to be laid out and stuff. So that's what's difficult in my mind. I think building a game from scratch and you could definitely do it, Connor, based on what you said.
I guess I never thought about that, like putting your game when it gets a physical release on a Game Genie and like messing around with it. That'd be very interesting.
Yeah, I have some codes for From Below, actually. One of the
I've seen people do Game Genie codes for homebrew games, which is wild.
That's crazy.
And I feel like I should be able to write them myself. Like I think if you were an assembly programmer, you'd probably be like, oh yeah, this memory address stores this. But for me, I'm like, I don't know. It's C. And then something outputs assembly for me. I have no idea where anything is located. I wouldn't be able to analyze my own game in a disassembler. So yeah, somebody else did the work and figured out how to, like, for the From Below, they wanted to kind of practice at high levels. So they came up with some codes to basically allow practicing a bit easier, which is pretty cool.
So you talked about Contra earlier, and we're talking about your game. Mm-hmm. How, just as a programmer, how difficult would it be to program something like the Konami code into your game to make it easier, give you more lives? Like, is that something that's easy or is that difficult? Because I know zero about it. So
yeah, that's cool. So Konami code's in Witch and Wiz, actually.
Really?
It goes, but it just takes you to the sound test screen.
Okay. Oh.
So that part of it, like actually reading the Konami code, is pretty easy. And then the tweak stuff you talked about, yeah, that stuff's simple, generally. The hard parts are usually like adding new mechanics.
Okay.
Or like large scale changes, tweaking values, stuff like that, like making the game faster or doing more damage, that kind of stuff. That stuff's super easy, usually. there's some exceptions, but like the movement speed, I tried to make a turbo mode for Witch and Wiz. It would just kind of double the frame rate. But it turned out I had a bunch of assumptions about it always taking 16 frames to move the character from one square to another. So they would it would run in turbo mode, but they would get halfway to their square and then teleport, stuff like that. So
teleport mode.
It's like a novelty.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to spend a bunch of time making this run in turbo mode. But yeah, anyway, point being, most tweaks are easy, adjusting kind of tunable things. Adding new game modes, stuff like that. That's usually where the big challenges are.
Matt Hewson, developer of Witch and Wiz, thank you very much for joining us for this interview. I had a lot of fun here. Did you guys have a good time?
Yeah, this was great.
Where would you like everybody to find you on the internet?
You can go to matthewson.com. But I'm most, and I think that'll have links to everything, but I'm most active on Twitter. And I'm also Matt Hewson on Twitter, MattHughson.
Thank you. Yeah. This has been the Homebrew Game Club podcast. You can find links to our Discord, back episodes of the show, or other social media at homebrewgameclub.com. And you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at HB Game Club. If you like the show, please help us out by leaving a review on iTunes or Spotify, or by telling all your retro gaming friends about our podcast. If you have comments or a suggestion for a game that you'd like to hear us talk about, shoot us a message on social media or email us at homebrewgameclub@gmail.com. Our opening music is by Twee, or what was the other way to say that? Yes. You can find him on Twitter at TUI2A03, where you can also find a link to his SoundCloud. You can follow me, Nick, on Twitter, Instagram, or Video Game Sages at Divertov. That's DVERTOV. Bart is on Instagram as Clever Username Needed, no spaces. And Connor is on Twitter at CONORNASH, also no spaces. Tune in next time to the Homebrew Game Club, when we will be talking about Nescape for the NES. We will see you then. Thank you for listening.